Welcome to People Power and Politics, our talk, riveting interviews, community updates, in-depth analysis. That's People Power and Politics. We tell it to you as it is. No holds barred. You are the people. You have the power. We bring you the politics. To listen to our show, be a guest, or to advertise, visit www.pppradio.nyc. That's www.pppradio.nyc.
Five, four, three, two, one. A very warm welcome to everyone. We are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Karim Creighton, who is the Senior Director of Voting at the Brennan Center for Justice. Our topic, the Black and Latino voting power under threat in redistricting case, is of utmost importance. The lawsuit is against Galveston County, Texas, brought by Black and Latino residents over its racially discriminatory district map. The county is where Juneteenth began. This interview will delve into the critical aspects of voting rights and suppression, redistricting, and the profound implications for minority communities. Welcome, sir. Such a pleasure and honor to have you here with us.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So if you could please briefly introduce yourself and the Brennan Center for Justice organization.
Sure. My name is Karim Creighton. I'm the Senior Director for Voting and Representation at the Brennan Center for Justice. Brennan Center was started about 30 years ago, named after the famed justice, member of the Warren Court era, Justice William J. Brennan from the great state of New Jersey, and really one of the lions of the court in expanding our conceptions of everything from voting and representation to the rights of the accused, to general fairness and accessibility of government institutions. And the center, housed at NYU Law School, is his enduring legacy. And our work ranges from issues related to things that I spend a lot of time thinking about, voting and representation, where we think about defending the right to vote, making certain our representative institutions are reflective of the people that it seeks to serve, that, you know, we also address matters related to criminal justice reform, ending prison overcrowding, for example, and advancing decriminalization. And then also we think about liberty and national security, making certain that our government treats people with fairness and respects concerns of privacy. We do that through litigation, research, and communications work. And it has, you know, been an organization that has grown in size since I said it was founded about 30 years ago. We are happy to say one of the very few civil rights organizations that features not just lawyers and professionals in the communication space, but we have, I think, probably the largest number of PhDs in social science, including myself, in the business. And we deploy all of this expertise to make certain that when we are interested in learning more about how to make government better and how to understand policies as they affect us in our individual lives, our organization works hard to try to bring knowledge and really clarity to the conversation. So that's our story.
Well, what a story it is. So going back to our topic of conversation here, can you provide an overview of the current redistricting case threatening Black and Latino voting power? And also, how are redistricting decisions typically made and what factors influence the outcomes?
Well, that's a lot to talk about. Let's see. You said you have 30 minutes, so let's try to sandwich it in this brief question, a brief response. The case Galveston County is a case that involves a really highlighted part of the civil rights legal framework, which is the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was adopted primarily to make sure that people of color who had been subject to marginalization, particularly during the Jim Crow era, had a route to get government to pay attention when they fall short of respecting the rights of people of color After obviously a lot of protest and final congressional action in the 1960s. In this context, where we're talking about redistricting, the Voting Rights Act often is used to call government into account where the maps that it draws does not, the maps that it draws would not fairly reflect the political power and influence of people of color. What that means in practice is, as is usually the case after a census, the jurisdiction like Galveston County has to redraw its election districts to comply with the one person, one vote standard, a standard advanced in part by, again, Justice Brennan when he was on the court. But in doing it, you rebalance the number of people in each district. The Voting Rights Act requires that you take attention to the ability of people of color to elect candidates of choice. And what that has meant in practice is, particularly where you've got evidence that white voters don't work in conjunction with other voters to figure out, you know, mutually agreeable candidates, a situation we call racially polarized voting. Where that is true, and some other things have shown, the law requires the district to draw maps where people of color have the ability to elect candidates, usually in a majority of a district. Mm-hmm. Now, traditionally, that has been interpreted or used in cases where only one racial group is making the assertion that they need to have a district or multiple districts that reflect that opportunity to elect. Galveston County is a little different in that the case there involves plaintiffs of two different racial groups, African-Americans and Latinos, two of the largest groups in Texas among non-white communities. In Galveston County, they very much have a history of voting together. And because of that, they have been grouped in a district together in large quantities that allows them working together to elect the candidate that they mutually agree to. The issue in Galveston County now is whether or not the act should be interpreted in a way to reflect the that joint coalition, called coalition districts. And traditionally, at least in the Fifth Circuit where Galveston County is located, the court has respected instances like that and says, yes, you treat two groups that work together where the evidence shows that they are working together as though they worked if there was just one non-white group bringing the claim. And the initial case in Galveston County actually recognized that that's exactly the right answer, except when the appeals court looked at it, three of the judges got together and they said, well, yeah, we think existing law actually does favor the fact that these two groups grouped together said that Galveston should have drawn a district where they were put together as a majority in one of the districts. They said, yeah, we agree, you're right, but we actually think the law is wrong. And so we're going to ask the whole Fifth Circuit to change the law. Now, that is a radical departure from the Fifth Circuit of the 1980s and 90s that devised this rule. It was an interpreted principle that made a lot of sense and that everybody had relied on, which is in one way why Galveston County had a district that was a coalition district. So the question now presented to the Fifth Circuit as a whole, more than a dozen judges on the court, they have to decide together whether or not they're going to continue to respect that interpretation of the Voting Rights Act. Now, what might spark the change, you might ask? Well, in fact, one of the judges, the judge who wrote the opinion and the three-judge panel that said, let's take it to the whole court, Edith Jones, was actually on the court at the time originally when the Fifth Circuit recognized coalition districts. The only difference now is that we have a fundamentally different Supreme Court of the United States. Back then, it was roughly managed between the Berger and the Rehnquist courts, two somewhat conservative courts, but that usually sat somewhere in the middle. And where they're reviewing circuits like the Fifth Circuit, they have taken kind of a middle of the road approach, sometimes conservative, maybe sometimes not so much. And the Fifth Circuit kind of took the view, having looked at all the facts in Texas, to say initially, yeah, of course we should recognize coalitions. That's a history, it's based on the history of the area. They tend to cooperate together politically. We want to make sure that their rights are respected. Today, we now have a different court, as I said, and it's the court where Chief Justice Roberts is the chief, and you have essentially what our president, Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center, has said is a supermajority, unbound by prior precedent, and really driven largely, unfortunately, by ideological commitments rather than the sort of management of law. And what that has meant is that circuits like the Fifth Circuit are trying their hand at new theories and revisiting old theories that they would never have under previous administrations of the Supreme Court. And so you have this circuit asking the question, well, maybe we were wrong back then. Should we reconsider it? And at issue, just to be sure we're clear about the stakes here, are opportunities where neither one of these groups would have been able to have a district where they alone could direct the outcome of elections because they were the majority, but working together that they could. This interpretation, if Edith Jones gets her way and the majority of the circuit agree with her, it means that African-Americans and Latinos can only advance a claim under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act if they are singularly, as a group, large enough to control a district or drive the outcome. And that's really unfortunate. It's inconsistent with the Fifth Circuit's earlier decision. But more than that, it really ignores the growth and the history of Texas. And so if that happens, we are, A, in the immediate sense, facing instances where a lot of existing and functional districts are going to be broken up, where coalitions are the basis of those districts. But it also invites the Supreme Court of the United States into the game, which may lead us to an even more unfavorable interpretation that doesn't just limit the ability of districts to be drawn with one community driving the action so that their ability to elect is recognized, but they may just say Section 2 is fundamentally unconstitutional altogether. A lot of states and jurisdictions have invited them to do that. So far, they haven't taken the bait, but this is one such case where you could see a further narrowing of an act that has been quite effective at changing political opportunity. So that's the long and short of the explanation, but I'm happy to answer more if you're interested.
Yes, I am. So, you know, speaking about the residents, one of the plaintiffs, a Black, and she's Black, Patricia Tolliver, and she's lived in Galveston for over 75 years. She spoke about the right to vote and to vote for candidates of choice, and that people have died and it's time to speak up. And in another interview that I did, you know, the gentleman said every voter card is covered with blood. So how do you see all of this impacting, you know, the changes? How do you see all of this impacting the minority communities in terms of changes and challenges affecting them disproportionately, the Black and Latino voters?
Well, I think the point you started with about the history is important. It shouldn't be overlooked that we didn't get this act on the books except for a lot of protest and sacrifice by people of color. The story of the marchers going across the Edmund Pettus Bridge on a Sunday morning, being met by police and beaten with clubs and attacked with dogs and tear gas, is the real galvanizing force to get Congress, which had failed to act, to finally do so. And there's so many scholars that have written, I'm among them, how significant the Voting Rights Act has been as a legacy to that sacrifice, but also really a crown jewel of the civil rights revolution. And so what we're seeing now is an attack to undo all of that progress. So it is definitely an insult to that legacy. But more important, and it's fair to say, it's a slap in the face to the realities for communities of color in Texas and other places like it, particularly in the South. Texas is a booming state in terms of population. Much of that population growth is due to people of color. But you wouldn't believe that if you just looked at the representative institutions like the districts in Galveston County that are being crafted largely by white people, largely for the purpose of limiting political opportunity for people of color. And so when you think about that continued growth and what democracy calls for, which is institutions that reflect majority will, an increasing number of people nearing to a majority are clamoring in a large part of the state for districts and power that reflects their concern. And increasingly what they're met with is a brick wall. And unfortunately, part of that brick wall is the law telling them that's politics. You don't have a say because the majority, or in this case, a minority that happens to control power, says you don't. That's not a sustainable way of doing business. And you can call it a lot of things. It's become increasingly hard to call that a small d democracy.
Exactly. So looking at strategies and advocacy, your organization, the Brennan Center for Justice, obviously y'all are doing tremendous work. What strategies are organizations like yours and other advocacy groups and organizations employing to protect the voting rights of Black and Latino communities during this redistricting process?
Well, in talking about the case that I started with Galveston County and in other cases, we are certainly deploying our resources to assure that the rights of these voters are defended. So in Galveston, we have filed an amicus brief, a friend of the court brief, to support our understanding that the interpretation of the Voting Rights Act, particularly by the Fifth Circuit, where Galveston is located, support the use of a district by coalitions to essentially comply with the Act's commitment to make sure that people are fairly represented. We also, of course, are very much into the research to support the continued understanding that this is not a thing of the past. The Supreme Court has tried to get us to believe. We recently published a groundbreaking report on the racial turnout gap, the gap between the level of turnout by white voters compared to voters of color, and showing some of the harmful effects that the Supreme Court's decision limiting the application of the Voting Rights Act has had on the ability of people to participate in elections on an equal basis. And that is the very thing that they said in their decision, Shelby County versus Holder, that was the sort of important measure of why civil rights laws might be necessary. We show that since 2013, when the famed or infamous Shelby County decision was announced, we've shown that the racial turnout gap has increased throughout the country, but has increased the fastest in the very places where the special provisions of the Voting Rights Act, called preclearance, were applied. So in places like Texas, we've seen a faster growing and more challenging, more acute gap in the level of turnout. And that, we think, is due to the enactment of a series of suppressive laws that aren't regulated in the same way that they were prior to Shelby County. And what that has meant over these years from then till now, we considered about a billion different data points in this analysis. We show that hundreds of thousands of votes by people of color were never cast because of the absence of a more robust version of the Voting Rights Act. That point leads me to the last, which is that we are continuing our advocacy on the on Capitol Hill to make sure that we get an emboldened and reinvigorated Voting Rights Act in answer to the Supreme Court's cutting back on it. We are strongly in favor of two federal bills that have been pending in the United States Congress, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, both of which would significantly improve the ability of voters living in these jurisdictions to assure that their voices are heard in the way districts are drawn. Just as an example, for the Freedom to Vote Act, we craft a system where Congress would require jurisdictions, certainly at the congressional districting level, to adopt independent redistricting commissions. That would radically limit the extent to which the partisan incentives to just, you know, advantage your friends and fence everybody out who doesn't agree with you in districts. That would limit that perverse incentive in redistricting. But more important, with the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, Voting Rights Advancement Act, we'd reinstall an enhanced and present day version of preclearance so that the federal government could oversee new changes in election laws like redistricting to assure that they don't do harm to the ability of communities of color to get elected. So we're working on all of those levels, the legislative, the advocacy, and the research levels to make sure that we're building a system that is equal to the rich and diverse community that increasingly in the South we're starting to see.
So you spoke earlier about, you know, the historical incidents where, you know, persons marching and different things. What can we do right now, ordinary citizens, to contribute to ensuring fair representation?
Sure. Well, one thing everybody can do, and I say this, you know, as a building block of everything else, is, of course, to vote. We almost take for granted that voting actually is sort of a part of a democracy. But we increasingly see now is there any number of efforts to make voting more difficult and less available to people, particularly people of color. And it is done because the people who are suppressing know what the impact is if people do show up. So the only answer is you have to show up, and you have to show up both in big, you know, national contests and local contests as well. The Galveston County case is a county matter. So how the county drew its districts was in part informed by, when it was allowed, public input. And that leads me to the other thing that has to be a part of the formula. There's voting, which always happens on an election day at a regular schedule, but the work before you get to the vote has to be being engaged with our activities of our elected members. They are working on our behalf, but you have to hold them accountable to do the things that we need them to do. And that means both keeping track of what elected officials are doing in office, speaking out so that they hear from you and your friends and family and neighbors what they are doing right and what they need to do better on. And of course, that also presumes we are working and talking to each other in the public. We have to be organized in a way so that we can see each other's common interests and concern, that we work out what might be best for our community, and then we can voice those concerns and interests to our elected officials. All of those things are so critically necessary to our democracy to work. They don't always get you on television. They don't always get written up in the newspaper, but or on social media. I should be more current and modern with our technology. But that's really the blocking and the tackling of what makes democracies work. And we've got to get to that. And we got to get to that not just in the easy places where people roll out the red carpet. Sometimes we have to do that in places. In fact, we might have to do that more in places where the government isn't trying to open itself up to be reviewed and to be held accountable. That's exactly the place you have to watch. And by the time you wait to an election, if you wait till an election to start getting involved, I'm glad you're getting involved, but you're missing a whole lot of the narrative. So I would just really encourage on all of those levels to, you know, redouble our efforts, not just to, you know, be involved ourselves, absolutely, but to bring people along with you. Because really, it's always a numbers game. The more people hear from those of us who view government as being an instrument for our interests and not the other way around, that we aren't the interests for government, we're not the instruments of government, then people who are in government, both because they run for something and listen to the people, but also because they have a heart for service, are going to do a better job. And so that's the thing that I would, you know, ask for anybody thinking about what we can do. Those are absolute positively key elements of what we as citizens have to do to make democracies work.
Okay, so it is 2024 and there's a general elections coming up in November. So let's look at the broader implications beyond this specific case. What broader implications does the outcome of this redistricting challenge have for voting rights across the country?
Well, as I said, I mean, these are cases that will at least be presented to the Supreme Court for decision making. And where those cases get heard, the Supreme Court is making national policy. And the people who are, you know, very happy about the way the Supreme Court does business and who's on the Supreme Court right now are eager to hear more and more opportunities are available for the Supreme Court to create new decisions that reflect their understanding and vision for America. So the stakes are, for all of these cases, a potential to remake not just the law, but the country that the law is supposed to govern. So if you're not sure at all about why you know, in a national contest, it's important to show up and vote. Every, you know, president has the potential when there's a vacancy to nominate someone in the mold of what their vision is for the United States of America going forward. It is a generational decision. And, you know, who the president is, who your senators are, all matter. And the people, as I say, there are people in this country who know that and have been working decades to shape this court in that manner. So if you like it, then, you know, you're getting what you want. If you don't like it, it won't change anytime soon unless you vote and change your leadership. So that's the importance of showing up to vote, having your voice, no matter what you want to share with government, but having it known.
And this kind of segues into my next question, which you partly answered, but I'm still going to ask, because this is happening in Texas. Your organization is in New York. I'm in New York, and somebody might be thinking, okay, what does that have to do with me? So if you could just explain how those similar challenges can impact voting rights for other minority groups and communities, and, you know, just the general election, the 2024 general elections overall.
So let me just say a word about why it matters to everybody, really, no matter what part of the country you live in. You know, if you are a New Yorker, you know, you live in a very rich and diverse community filled with a lot of different people from very many different communities and experiences and backgrounds. And just as in a state like Texas, New York has the benefit of using the Voting Rights Act to shape how election districts get drawn, and where the United States Supreme Court makes decisions where it's interpreting the Voting Rights Act, those decisions will apply in New York as they do in Texas. And so, you know, every case, as I said, that finds its way to the Supreme Court has the potential to shape national policy. So that's the, you know, stake, if you will, that has everyone really sort of answering what the call about how might this affect me. Blacks and Latinos are the two groups that are at issue in Galveston, but this would, you know, be just as applicable to, under the right circumstances, Asian Americans, or, you know, whether they're coupled with African Americans or Latinos. It's all tied together because the point of the Voting Rights Act is to make certain that we have, again, an election system and a representative government system that's equal to the populations that it's supposed to serve. And if there is no Voting Rights Act, which, you know, we can't dismiss as a possibility, that means even if you are one group that has the claim to want a district that represents your group, you may not be able to do that if there's no Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act at all. So as I said earlier, what kind of Congress you have will matter to the kind of law that can get shaped. What kind of Senate in particular you have and what kind of president you have working together will shape the United States Supreme Court going forward. And those are lifetime appointments. And they will likely, there will be people who long outlive the president who appoints them. And that's really what's at stake. And it's always at stake.
Switching things up a bit, let's talk about the Supreme Court ruling in favor of Black Alabama voters in an unexpected defense of the voting rights. Last year, the Supreme Court issued a surprising 5-4 ruling in favor of Black voters in a congressional redistricting case from Alabama, with two conservative justices joining liberals in rejecting a Republican-led effort to weaken a landmark voting rights law. The decision was keenly anticipated for its potential effect on control of the closely divided U.S. House of Representatives. Because of the ruling, new maps are likely in Alabama, Louisiana, that could allow Democratic-leaning Black voters to elect their preferred candidates in two more congressional districts.
Well, I think the court in that case really surprised a lot of people in that they stuck to precedent. As I said earlier, there have been cases since the adoption of the act that have sort of made the case for why it is both historically appropriate, but also constitutionally necessary to have a Voting Rights Act. And the court this time, despite being invited by the state of Alabama to radically reread, if not eliminate, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, said, "We think discrimination is still a significant feature of our politics, such that we need to have tools for our minority citizens to bring their claim." And so on one level, it settled for now the question as to whether or not there will be Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act that minority voters will be able to challenge instances where the state does not fairly represent them in the drawing of districts. It also left some questions open, which came up in some of the concurrences in the decision, where there were questions about whether there were certain cases where maybe the issue of Section 2's constitutionality might be revisited. So how did it affect the debate? On one level, it settled, at least for some time in Alabama, whether or not Alabama would have districts that would fairly represent its population. The answer is yes. However, it left open broader questions about whether in future cases the court might want to consider whether or not the application of Section 2 in all instances was fully compliant with the Constitution, and that's invited any number of actors to show up and challenge it. So the debate continues, even if the immediate question in the Alabama case was settled.
What factors contributed to the unexpected 5-4 decision, where conservative justice aligned with liberals to uphold the Voting Rights Act in the Alabama redistricting case? And what implications does this have for future legal challenges to voting rights legislation?
Well, I think you can look at both the facts of the case as being a contributing factor, and also just the, for the moment, I'm going to call it the optics. The facts of the case are pretty stark. I'm actually originally from Montgomery, Alabama, and was there and contributed to part of how this record got developed in another role. And the facts couldn't be more stark. Alabama has a long history of racial discrimination. It's quite clear that African Americans are large enough to be able to have two districts where their outcomes, where the district outcomes would reflect the ability of African Americans to elect candidates. And having in that time worked in the state legislature, I can say from personal experience that the drawing of the lines and the process leading to it were perfectly designed to keep public opinion out, but in particular arguments on behalf of people of color out. And that was exactly in sort of a textbook case of how, particularly given racially polarized voting, how the Voting Rights Act should be used to support the rights of African Americans to have districts that reflect their interest. That's sort of one part of the story. The other part of the story, though, was this was just obviously my read of, it was not just my read of the facts of the case. Three judges sat and listened to a lot of testimony, including a lot of shenanigans on the part of the Republican majority, bless them. And these were not the most stark raving liberal people you'll ever want to meet. In fact, two of the judges, all three of the judges had Republican appointments, including one, at least one of them, that was a Trump appointee. And those people, looking at the facts and listening to a lot of testimony, said, yeah, this is a violation of the law. So you have the Supreme Court looking at this textbook case and seeing that, look, Republican judges sat with this and said, this doesn't work. They would have had a hard time saying, well, we disagree. Because they would have had to sign with the state of Alabama, which is clearly one of the perennial violators of the Voting Rights Act. That's just not my opinion. That's fact in terms of prior cases. So I think all of those things go into play. But again, this is still the Supreme Court that is a supermajority. And I think that is informed by, if not driven by, ideological viewpoint. They waited to give what was essentially a straightforward answer for 2 years. And in those 2 years, the state of Alabama elected district representatives under an illegal map. And what that meant was African Americans were underrepresented and continue to be so even to this day until the new map elects a representative in the fall of 2024. So the delayed justice here meant that and means that policies adopted in Congress underrepresent the African American community in Alabama. What it also means is, though, as I said, even though the state of Alabama's case, at least for now, has been settled, it still invites a continued amount of challenge on the part of people around the country that are trying to take their own pot shots at Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So in some ways, it had settled the issue in front of, or the conflict in Alabama. It has not really resolved the issue of how Section 2 is to be interpreted. That's the ongoing conversation, I think, that we see in a number of other cases, including the one in Galveston County.
I like this term that you use, generational decisions. That is deep. So let's look at the future. So the future outlook, what are the prospects for securing and protecting voting rights for Black and Latino communities in future redistricting processes? Are there any promising opportunities for change, in your opinion?
Well, I put it right back to the two pending bills before Congress that, you know, if we have the right combination of people that support them in 2025, these can become law. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the Freedom to Vote Act are both bills that can radically improve the opportunity for people of color to be meaningful players in the districts that will represent them. So I would really suggest, again, thinking about the position that the candidates who are on your ballot take about both of those positions. And of course, listening carefully to the presidential debates, because I think democracy is always on the ballot, but it couldn't possibly be higher on the ballot than in this election.
Yes. So Dr. Creighton, can you share how one can get, you know, to learn more about your organization and the tremendous work that you all are doing?
Sure. Our site is chock full of great information. We're at brennancenter.org, BRENNANcenter.org. And, you know, we have any number of outlets that give you, you know, a great look into all the different work that we do.
Thank you so much, Dr. Karen Creighton, Senior Director of Voting at the Brennan Center for Justice. It was such a pleasure and an honor speaking with you.
People Power in Politics, Hard Talk, riveting interviews, community updates, in-depth analysis. That's People Power in Politics. We tell it to you as it is. No holds barred. You are the people. You have the power. We bring you the politics. To listen to our show, be a guest, or to advertise, visit www.pppradio.nyc. That's www.pppradio.nyc.